Every Woman is a feminist show that highlights the struggles, triumphs, and accomplishments of women and girls and the men who support them. Every Woman includes a rich intersection of female voices that represent a wide range of ethnicities, social and economic status, as well as political and spiritual beliefs, with the purpose to enact social, political, environmental, and economic change. The views and opinions expressed on Every Woman are those of the hosts and the guests and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, KKFI staff, board, or management.
Hello, everyone out there, and welcome to Every Woman here on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is Una here at our world headquarters at the busy intersection of 39th and Main with Rachel behind the soundboard today doing all the engineering and keeping us on the air. How are you, Rachel?
I'm really good. It's great to be back here in Studio A at the world headquarters.
Yes. And Fiona, our other host, is joining us from home because we are being extra safe here at KKFI and keeping just two folks in the studio at all times. Fiona, are you there?
Hi. I am. Hi, Una. Hi, Rachel.
Very good. Are you on the couch?
I am on the couch. I have two co-hosts joining me on the couch. We have Poppy, who is one of our cavaliers, and we have Max, who is a wonderful tabby cat. I don't think they intend to participate in the conversation, however.
I certainly hope not, although they might raise the bar for the conversation level for some of our programs. That's just a joke. However, we have a special guest today who has been on the program before, and they have appeared on KKFI several times because of the tremendous amount of work that they do in our community right here in Kansas City, and because they have such a great heart and a mighty soul. We are going to be speaking with Chris Wade, who is one of the executive directors and founders of the Justice Project of Kansas City. The mission of the Justice Project, which is a peer-based nonprofit human rights organization, is to give criminal justice and social justice systems advocacy and navigation for women in poverty who may be suffering from a multitude of challenges, including homelessness, discrimination, addiction, mental illness, domestic violence, prostitution, and other forms of sexual exploitation and trafficking. The Justice Project has been running since 2007 with Chris and several very dedicated volunteers who have really helped to positively change the lives of hundreds of women from the streets of Kansas City. And that's especially important to talk to Chris today because while we look at our lives and how COVID has affected us, and we look at the inconvenience of working from home, you know, the trials and tribulations of having to wear a mask going to the mall and everything like that, the folks that already were existing on the margins of society, that already were facing overwhelming burdens that would floor any of us if it was dropped on us all of a sudden, those folks have suffered even more from the impacts of COVID. And so we want to talk with Chris about the Justice Project, about how the struggle has advanced this year, and what's going to happen here in the future. So Chris, welcome to Every Woman.
Well, thank you, Una. I'm pleased to be here, and I appreciate the invitation.
We are, as always, you know, your cause is such a good one. We really want to make sure that folks out there know about the Justice Project and know about what you do, how you do it, and who are some of the folks that are out there volunteering. Can you tell our listeners, you know, I gave a little bit of an intro, but can you talk a little bit about the foundation of the Justice Project and what inspired it?
Well, Back in about 2007, 2008, a sister, Donna Ryan, who is a Sister of Mercy, and the Mercy Sisters are very involved in education and social justice causes, and she and I met and were working with another organization that worked with women who had been exploited through prostitution. We realized, though, that there were a lot of women out in the streets and in the urban core who really needed help as well beyond that population. And we really wanted to be able to touch more lives. So Sister Donna Ryan and I jumped out on our own, and we started the Justice Project and became a 501c3 charitable organization, and we were off running. And we serve women and girls, and this includes our trans and lesbian and bi and question women as well. And because we realized there was a service gap out there, that a lot of people were just falling through the cracks. They didn't understand the various systems out here, or they had had terrible experiences with those systems. And we realized that a lot of people had been traumatized by the various systems that were intended to help them. So we kind of made it a mission to get out in the streets and start reaching out to folks and trying to figure out who all was out there that was falling through the cracks. And that's what we how we started. And we basically, our objective is to try to help people understand the systems that are out here that we're all constantly forced to deal with, and to learn how to utilize those systems to their benefit, and with the ultimate goal being their self-sufficiency as much as possible under their circumstances.
And I know, too, that one of the systems that you have to struggle with sometimes is the fact it's almost an endless cycle of a woman is forced into prostitution due to poverty, and then is often arrested, and then subjected to fines and possible imprisonment and penalties, which put her even further into debt, and it just makes the whole system worse and worse. And I know you've talked a bit about that before.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, the risk for falling into that kind of stuff is really directly related to the level of vulnerability that an individual is suffering from, you know, because honestly, nobody that I have ever known, and we're a survivor organization, we've all been subjected as women to a number of crimes against ourselves, but we really feel like no one really decides they want to get into this for the fun of it. You know, it's like, gosh, I think that just sounds like a great lifestyle. No. And most people are drawn into it simply through various circumstances, poverty, homelessness, addiction, mental illness that goes undiagnosed and untreated. And in the case, lots of times, of our LGBTQI folks, they become, you know, as they become more in their authentic selves, they become lots of times, not because they want to, but because they're kind of pushed into it through circumstances, they become estranged from their families and normal support systems. So oftentimes, folks who are very vulnerable end up in the streets at a very young age. Very young age. And that increases their vulnerability right there to all kinds of things. When you're, you know, when a person is basically focused on survival, that's about as vulnerable as it gets.
So could you describe, say, a typical week of the sort of work that you might do at the Justice Project along with the volunteers and staff?
Sure. Things are a little bit out of normal right now just due to the, you know, COVID-19 infections. But normally we hold a women's group once a week, and any and all women are welcome to come. We greet them. You come as you are. We normally hold it over at Bishop Sullivan West, which is formerly called St. James Place during the meal program, where they can have a meal and come in a separate area with us and dialogue if they want to. They may have grievances. They may need help with certain things. We discovered that many women out in the streets don't read or are not literate or have undiagnosed learning disabilities. So knowing where we are on a particular day of the week at the exact time every week, you know, they may have paperwork that they don't understand or are unable to read. We can help them with that sort of thing. We can make appointments with them for later. We basically try to figure out, you know, what does an individual have going? You know, why is she here? What's her... You know, and they may not even know. They may just want help. They may just be desperate. So basically what we try to do is help people build a foundation for independence. And we believe in housing first, so we spend a lot of time trying to help people locate housing. We don't have any of our own, but we have a number of great community partners like SAVE and various shelters, different organizations that work to help people get off the streets. So we work a lot on housing first because we've realized that if someone has a place that they can hang their hat, they can call their own, if it's a room somewhere with a lock on the door, then a lot of their vulnerabilities instantly go down. I mean, they may still be smoking crack, but they're not going to be doing it out in the community where they put themselves and other people at risk. You know, and then it's easier when they have a place to be for them to start concentrating on making other things better. And that's where we can come in with system navigation and education and guidance through those things. Lots of times they've got legal issues that need to be cleared up. We partner with legal aid and the public defender's office, and some private attorneys, and the Volunteer Attorney Project here in Kansas City to help people overcome any legal issues. And you're absolutely right, Una. When someone gets picked up for an ordinance offense in Kansas City, whether it's prostituting or shoplifting or anything like that, it is so easy for that to spiral in just downwards so quickly to where all of a sudden, it's almost more than a person, especially someone who's homeless and has no income and no resources and really is struggling to overcome those things. It really gets challenging. So we do a lot of educating and working with players in the various systems, in the social service systems, police, courts, probation, parole, corrections, various service providers that work with our population so that they can understand what these folks are dealing with out here. And we've dealt with it ourselves, so we can relate to them as peers, and that helps. Basically, we work every day on building trust relationships, and that's where it starts with our population. The population that we serve is generally pretty low on the food chain in the streets. They have a whole multiplicity of stressors on them, and they need a hand up. And they need someone to say, hey, there is a way out of this, and we can show you. We'll show you the way. So we're kind of the guides to the way out. Sometimes we go to court with people, help them get there. We can help people get set up with medical, all the basic foundational services that people need to exist.
I know there's...
Right now, because of COVID, we're not, able to do things in the normal way. But we're still reaching out in the streets. We're still communicating with our constituents the best that we can. And we're basically, right now, what we're doing is concentrating. We concentrated a lot in the beginning on the census because that's really important for our homeless folks to be counted.
I was going to say, I really want to talk a bit about the census issue, but also how COVID has impacted you. We have to take a short station break, though, and then I want to come in and jump right into that. So if you wouldn't mind holding on, we will be right back. And welcome back to Every Woman, where we've been hearing from Chris Wade, who has been telling us about the history and the mission and some of the activities that are done by the Justice Project of Kansas City. And right as we kind of cut her off there to go to our station break, she was about to talk about a focus this year on making sure there was adequate census representation, but also, well, let's start with that, Chris, since you were starting to talk a little bit about that.
Well, I don't want to belabor that point too much because, unfortunately, it's moot now. But we really knew that it was critical for a lot of the folks that we served to be counted. I mean, these are folks who may not come out of their abandoned house for 3 or 4 days, and no one may even know that they exist in that residence, you know, since it's not a real residence. You know, and we know that the allocation of funds for support of social service and social justice issues really depend on the census. And so we felt that that was kind of a critical thing to try to get done. But right away, COVID hit. And I sit on several coalitions and two state task forces because, you know, along with the direct service that we do, mm-hmm. We also do a lot of work on systemic change. So I started hearing about the virus in February. And we had partners all over the country who do similar work that we do. And we were hearing from California and Washington and New York from some of our partners that something, that the virus was around and something was going on, but we weren't really hearing much here. But by the end of February, you know, we were really getting clued into what was going on. And so starting the first part of March, we hit the streets with that information, you know, trying to explain to folks, this is what's coming, this is what it is, this is what we need to do to try to stay safe. You know, we passed out information and tried to explain to people so that they would understand what was happening. Unfortunately, we had just had several women get jobs for the first time ever in their lives. And, of course, they all lost work, and because most of them had not worked long enough to get any unemployment or workers' comp or anything like that, they were out in the cold for a while. And many of them, that was the first job they'd ever had in their adult lives. You know, so it wasn't like you could just hop right out and become an IT person that could work at home or, you know, do the typical things. They were had service industry jobs and, you know, hotels, things like that, where everything just tanked. So a lot of what we're doing now is helping people just basically keep alive. We're helping with medication, rent support, you know, feeding people. In Missouri, you know, it's a very punitive state. A number of our drug felons, for example, are still not able to get food stamps, even if they haven't been arrested in 15 or 20 years. You know, it doesn't matter. If you are a certain type of drug felon in this state, you can't get that kind of help. That's really hurting people. And it also leads to more crime. I mean, you know, you need food, and you're not having a way to find any, and it's the weekend, and you can't get to a pantry, and there are no meal programs open. You might go shoplift a 99-cent pack of hot dogs and end up with an ordinance fence. You know, so basically what we're trying to do is help people stay in. We scurried around, tried to get all the housing vouchers that we have for folks pushed through and get people in somewhere so that they could be safe. And except for some of the hardcore folks that are, they're not going to come in off the streets no matter what. That's their shtick, and that's where they're going to be. We just keep reaching out to them and trying to help them the best we can. But right now, our direct service is pretty limited to just trying to keep people's heads above water and survive this. We've had two women pass away from COVID. Back in the spring, we've had 9 we know that were infected, all of whom duked it out at home. We have one quite ill at home right now. And, you know, and some of these folks still don't have Medicaid. It's very difficult right now to get your foundational services up. You can't just go places and be interviewed or do face-to-face meetings with various states and organizations. It gets a little complicated. Our folks don't have homes, a lot of them. They don't have computers at home where they can do stuff. You know, things like that. So, and this is an illness that I really believe came from the haves to the have-nots instead of the other way around. I mean, the have-nots don't fly on airplanes for business. They don't go on cruises to the Caribbean. They don't, you know, fly to Paris for vacation. They don't go to board meetings. You know, they don't stay in hotels and eat out in restaurants and party at bars a bunch, you know. They don't do things. They can't afford them. So we did not see this popping up in our population until it had been going for a bit of time. And then by the first part of April, we really started seeing it. And it was much easier to get help back then than it is now. Like I said, we have people at home right now fighting the virus on their own. So it's very challenging.
What sort of resources do you have for folks who may think they have COVID? Do you provide testing or any kind of medical resources?
We can't do testing. Basically, what we can do is help people with things they need to survive. Do they need their prescriptions filled? Do they need groceries? Do they need toilet paper, Kleenex? Things to help them get through it. Do they need help with their phone bill? Do they need help with rent? We have some resources. Now, we are a small grassroots organization. We survive completely on the grants that we write and donations from our wonderful, compassionate Kansas City community who continues to give to us. And, other than myself and one other employee, a care specialist who used to be a client and then became a board member and now is an employee, which is kind of how we like to do it, keep our folks involved in the process. We don't have any other staff. Our volunteers have been fabulous. They just put together a bunch of little survival bags that we took around to all our folks and made masks and supplied sanitizer, gift cards, all kinds of things to keep our folks going. And they also come and mingle with our women when we do our group when COVID's not going on. Because we really want to build a bridge between the women that we serve and the folks in the community, because lots of times there's a lot of bias and stigma on both parts, So we like to try to build those bridges. And it helps them, it helps the community folks understand that trauma is really at the root of everything that our population, our service population is dealt with. That's the core of everything. And if you can put it in that perspective and deal with them in a trauma-informed way, all kinds of good stuff can happen. And we also do long-term involvement with folks. We don't have a cutoff time. We let them, unless they're court-ordered to us or sent to us by probation and parole, which we get a lot of referrals from them, unless they're sent to us through another agency or the courts or something, we let them decide their level of involvement. It's not our job to tell them what to do. We let them start, telling us what they would like to have in their lives, and then we try to see if we can help them realize that.
Yeah, I love
with their participation. It's a partnership. I mean, we're no different than they are. They're us, we're them. They call us by our first names. We've walked in their shoes, and they understand that. And that's why lots of times we partner with law enforcement and other agencies when they're doing prostitution or trafficking operations so that we can be there when someone who's been victimized that way is apprehended. Then we can be right there to say, hey, guess what? You're not going to go to jail. You're going to come with us, and we're going to try to help you get out of this mess.
Yeah, that's really awesome to hear. How do women find you if they're in need?
Well, normally we're out in the streets quite a bit, just introducing ourselves to folks. And we've been doing this for a long time. I mean, I've been doing this kind of work for almost 20 years now, and so we're pretty well known in the streets. We've been out there a long time. Plus, we have volunteers and staff that used to be out there themselves and not that long ago. So we have a lot of connections in the streets. And, we don't just go running around willy-nilly crazy, I mean, you have to be careful when you're doing that kind of work. Also, too, we deal with a lot of bad guys. We testify in court quite a bit, and sometimes we testify for the prosecution, and sometimes we testify for the defense, depending on the situation. But people can find us by calling our business number, which is the number we're talking on right now, 816-769-3307. And that comes direct to the Justice Project, and they can leave a voicemail or
to pick up if we're not on the other line or in a web meeting like we're having to do a lot of right now. That's the best way to find us. And we do have a website, justiceprojectkc.org. It does have a donate button on it, but please don't use it right now. We're not trusting the ethers right now just because of all the hacking and everything that's been going on. But we do have a mailing address. It's P.O. Box 32804, Kansas City, Missouri, 64171. And people can donate to us through that or send us letters, call us. We do a lot of, normally we do a lot of reaching out to the community, a lot of trainings, a lot of educational presentations, churches, clubs, schools. We do a lot of training with police officers around the state. We sit on with the Missouri and Kansas Attorney General's trafficking task forces. So we do a lot of training about that. People can find us through either the Missouri or Kansas Attorney General's websites, trafficking websites as well. We're reachable through that. And so a lot of what we're doing right now is basically the direct services, keeping people alive. The system work is we're still working on the two task forces that we're on. We're fortunate enough to be able to work on policy and legislation and take the voices of our folks to those highest levels, so that they can be heard somewhere and get policy changes made. It's a battle in Kansas and Missouri, but yes, we continue to peck away at it.
Can you talk about any of the sort of activism things you do and policy changes? Because I know one of the things that is really important is to try to take the stigma away from sex work, because you talk about sex workers and immediately there's this stigma, and in some circles people are thought of as less than human.
And a lot of what we do is try to help people understand the dynamics involved, and really people think, oh, it's a career choice that somebody made. Well, really it's not. It's exploitation, and people are generally led to it by various vulnerabilities, mental illness, addiction, poverty, or they may be of a certain subset group that experiences more discrimination and bias than others, like some of our LGBTQI folks, some of our folks of color. I know our trans women of color have had a real rough go of it here in Missouri, especially in the last 2 years. We've had a number of our constituents who have lost their lives to murder. We don't always know the circumstances of all of those yet, because most of them are still under investigation. But, I think that when we work on the system stuff, one of the things that we've really worked hard on is helping educate the people who directly deal with these same folks, service providers or shelters or especially law enforcement and courts, to understand the dynamics involved, and that this isn't something that somebody does just because they love the heck out of it.
Right.
I mean, I think you would talk to anyone, male, female, anyone, and ask them if they enjoyed this work, and they may lie to you at first and say, oh, sure, it's great, But if you talk to them a little further, especially when they find out that we are peers, that we've walked in their shoes sometimes, in many of the situations that they've been in, then we find out, I'm miserable, I want out, I can't take this, it's horrible, what can I do? I want to kill myself. So we really try to instill hope in people and let people know, we will be with you no matter what. You have an ally now. If you go to jail, we'll still hang in there with you. You go to the penitentiary, we'll hang in there with you. When you get out, we'll be here for you. You relapse on dope, hey, we get it. We're still with you. You blow somebody's brains out, okay. Not what we like, because we kind of follow the thou shalt not kill thing. But if you do, we'll be there for you. Because we believe everybody needs an advocate. And lots of times, as we've done this work, as I've done this work over the last 15, almost 20 years, we have seen attitudes change. Donna, Sister Donna and I were talking on the phone the other day that, you know, we almost feel like, you know, on some levels we haven't worked ourselves out of a job because there's always going to be more folks that need it, need the assistance and the guidance, you know. We have seen things change. Trans women can come dressed as in their as their authentic selves. If they want to dress as a female and come to court, they can now. They will be, they can be referred to by their female name, by their chosen name in court. The police are now identifying trans women who are murdered as trans women once they figure that out. You know, so those might seem insignificant to people who aren't in the LGBTQI community, but for people who are, those kind of changes are huge, you know. So, you know, like over in Kansas at the state level, we've managed to get stiffer penalties for the people who exploit women as buyers in the trafficking scenario. So those guys have a much stiffer penalty now. They can go to prison for it now, and we'll have to pay a hefty fine, and we're even trying to make it so they lose their driver's licenses and all kinds of stuff. You know, so we've got a lot of work to do. We serve about 20-plus HIV-positive women. We have a number of trans women of color that we serve. You know, and so there's a long ways to go in educating the community and other providers and various systems about these folks. But we've tried to let people know that, especially in the area of prostitution, you know, it's a survival thing. If you see someone prostituting on the street, she's there. That's rock bottom. You know, you go to the street when there's nothing else, you know. So, and we don't see it as work. We understand why people want to call it sex work or sex workers. We have a little bit of a problem with that because we feel like that normalizes that. And people think, well, that's being more respectful. Not really. It might be more respectful for the pimp that he is a legitimate business guy. You know, but it doesn't make anything better for the victim.
That's exactly true.
It's not a career choice. It's exploitation at every level, even if you think you want to get into it on your own. You know, even if you think, well, that might be something I could handle, and you jump out there and try it, and it won't be long before terrible things happen, and you might lose your life. You know, but it's not work. It's not a career choice. It's not a vocation. It's exploitation at pretty much every level.
And I know Fiona's been wanting to jump in and ask a few questions here. It's a little hard to coordinate with Zoom, so I want to turn it over to Fiona because I know she's got some things to comment
Absolutely.
On.
I know you said earlier about how Missouri penalizes people and won't even let them have food stamps. I know from job applications that so many of them ask if you've got a criminal record and what the record is. And it's, if you even tick the box, so many companies don't even bother to check what the arrest or record was for. And it becomes very hard to actually find work once you've got a record. Are you doing anything to help any of the women seal their records or get them expunged to help them in that work arena? Is there anything going on for that?
I'm having a little bit hard time understanding that last part. To help the women, what?
Are you doing anything to help the women who have a record from prostitution, from sex work? Are you doing anything to help them get their records expunged?
Oh, yeah, we work on that all the time. But here's something that's pretty unfortunate. In the state of Missouri, it's almost impossible to get an expungement. And that's what it takes to get your record off. Now, if a person is in the middle of a case, let's say you got a little case going downtown somewhere in municipal court or wherever, and in the state cases particularly, there is an option. If the person, you know, if it comes out that it looks like they're going to be found guilty of this, they have an option. They don't have the option, but the judge or whoever is passing a sentence has the option of making it a suspended imposition of sentence, which means that
they go on probation, and if they fulfill all the terms of that probation, then sentence will not be imposed upon them, and many times that case will go away. Sometimes we can work with prosecutors or other folks ahead of time, and they may see, wait a minute, this is a little different than what we thought. Let's work with this person. We really try to steer people more into community service options, probation, this kind of thing, so that we can continue working with them in the community and get other community partners involved through that probation process, for example. However, if they get a suspended, they can also get an SES, which means that if they don't fulfill their obligations on this particular charge, then they can be incarcerated and have to fulfill their time in court, in prison, or in the county jail. So we try to work before they even get to court with their attorney, and, you know, because we're not lawyers, we try to partner with their attorneys, which we have pretty good luck with, and, try to help make a case so that the prosecutor and the judge and jury or whoever understands the circumstances involved. But a lot of what we're seeing now is, as opposed to women, I mean, we haven't had anybody go to jail for, like, almost a year of our core group of about 60 women, so that's huge for us. That shows us. And plus, with the exception of our homicide victims and the two who passed from COVID, we've ended up with almost the same number of women that we had this time last year. And that's how we measure success. Is everybody still alive at the end of the year? Usually not. But this year we were a little bit luckier than some other years. So we try to work before court on options, and then if they do get sentenced to something, we try to help them figure out their probation requirements, what they're supposed to do, get them hooked up with a provider that can do things that we aren't able to do for them. And we also try to help them get together the foundational services that they may need, because if you're able to feed yourself and have a place to be, then you're much more likely to succeed in everything, regardless of what you're doing. But it's a lot easier to fulfill, say, 7 years of state parole if you're not out in the streets. So we also work on trying to make laws fairer for people. Like, we can't lobby per se because we're a 501c3. However, we can come out in support of certain laws or certain actions, that kind of thing. And this thing about certain drug felons not being able to get food stamps in Missouri causes so many problems. I mean, people have no idea. And when they changed the law to where some drug felons could get it and others couldn't, I just thought, what world? So, we've got some really crazy laws here. We have a number of HIV-positive women, and those folks, our HIV laws are antiquated and scary in Missouri, and there are a lot of folks working diligently on those because that HIV has a huge impact on our community. And that's what we try to do. We just try to stick with them and support them and give them hope that they can do these things, and we see it working. We see that really long-term commitment and heavy-duty involvement. Unless they don't want it. And if they don't, that's fine. That's fine. We're here if you change your mind. But coming from a perspective of you're no different than we are, we're going to treat you like like anyone else that we would know. And, it's not rocket science. Be respectful of people. Treat them the way you want to be treated. The old golden rule concept, And people respond to that. And with our population who have serious abandonment issues, a lot of mental health issues, a lot of trauma, and huge trust issues, trust building is what we really have to do first. And that's what we spend most of our time doing. And long-term commitment. Let them know we're here. We're here. We're the ones that will stick with you. And we don't expect other people to do that like we do, because not everybody can sign on to a client for 7 years, But when we do that,
We see these people moving eventually out of the street, and it may take years. But eventually they start getting better, and eventually they get into housing, and eventually they start understanding the systems, and eventually they come out of it, and eventually they get their legal things. But it takes a long time. And so that's why we decided we're not going to have a 30-day limit or a cutoff limit or once you achieve housing, we're done with you. We'll stick with you as long as you want us to. And eventually it might just come to where they give us a phone call once a week. Hey, I'm doing good. And then maybe once a month. And then maybe we don't hear from them for 3 months because they're doing great. You know, but it's a process, and it's a long process with this population. And again, we don't expect everybody to do like we do because other people, you know, have different ways that they're required to do things. So, but we find that's what works with this population.
No, that makes
sense. And to meet them not as, you know, fabulous Miss Star, the escort, but to meet her as Pamela, the young lady from wherever. You know, we look for that little kernel of that real little individual inside there. And we find that person, and that's who we start appealing to.
Yeah,
it works.
That is really important. And I need to just pause again for a station break. And we will be right back with more conversation with Chris Waite. And welcome back to the Every Woman Show. We are in conversation with Chris Waite from the Justice Project. I want to circle back to something you said earlier. Your point is well taken to not refer to these folks who are exploited as sex workers, because it seems to legitimize it. And I honestly, I might be naive, but I sort of never thought of that. How do you refer to those folks that you give aid to?
We refer to those people as people who've been used in prostitution, prostituted people, people who were prostituting. You know, we look at it as prostitution, the word, or trafficking, the word, not as, you know, prostitute. We don't look at that as a noun. We look at it as a verb. It's something that somebody's done. It's not who they are. And that's kind of where it sort of got to us. And but, you know, if someone who is being used in prostitution, if they want to call themselves a sex worker, that's fine. You know, we're not on a campaign to make people call themselves a particular thing or not. But when we're talking to the media or we're talking to other providers, we really try to get them to understand that this is not work. It's not a vocation. It's not a career choice. And even if it maybe started out that way in some individual's mind, it quickly becomes something else because of the amount of the criminal element, the predatory level, and everything else that's out there in that world, you know. So because when people see it in the media, they see sex workers, they see sex work, they see those terms, it kind of tends to legitimize it, and they think, oh, it's a job, you know, she must choose that. You know, so we kind of have issue with that. So always when I do these trainings, especially when I go for the Attorney General's office for the media or for people like that, I try to help them understand that. And also the myth of legalization. They think, wow, if it was legal, you know, we wouldn't have all these problems. Then women could be legal and they wouldn't have to go to jail. Well, they're finding out in the countries where it has been legalized and the places it's been legalized that brings a whole new host of problems. One of the problems is it's increasing child prostitution, child trafficking. And that's been a real problem. And it allows, you know, the women are tested for, you know, HIV and the various STIs and that kind of thing. And that's great. But what about the buyers? They're not being tested. So if somebody inadvertently ends up positive for something that can't be cured with a shot in the rear end, they don't prostitute legally anymore. So then they're going to be back out there illegally and falling into the hands of the really bad traffickers and bad guys and possibly, you know, being trafficked other countries and all this stuff. But the other thing that the other terminology that kind of grates on my nerves, and I hear this a lot, and not just related to the women that we serve, but people in general who have fallen on hard times or they've got legal complications, they made those bad choices.
That's another one really gets on my last nerve. Because, you know, I got to thinking about that and thought, you know, do people really choose to be homeless? I mean, some people maybe in their mental illness might still be living under the bridge, and there's nothing that we can do to get them from under there. You know, so we just deal with them there. But generally, people don't just say, well, I think homeless is the way to go for me. I think I'll be an addict. I think I'll, you know, get hooked up with an abusive pimp for the rest of my life. I mean, people don't just make those conscious decisions, you know. And I see the decisions that they do make less as choices and more as decisions. You know, choice, and I looked this up in the dictionary, choice implies that you have things to choose from. You have options, you know.
Right.
And so let's say there's a woman at a particular point in time who is faced with this dire poverty, eviction, can't give the baby formula, whatever it might be, and she's absolutely desperate out of her mind. She doesn't think, well, I've got all these great things to choose from. Which should I choose? She thinks, oh, my God, what can I do? And in desperation, she thinks, well, I could sell my body. You know, but she doesn't think, that's not the first thing, you know, that comes to a person's mind,
right,
generally. And also, too, that's a decision that she's kind of forced to make in her mind. She may not be aware that there are people who could help her or agencies or resources for her. So based on her perception, at that point in time, she makes a decision to do a certain thing as opposed to choosing a bunch of things.
Right. It becomes a matter of survival at that point.
Exactly. And I hear this choice decision thing all the time. Treatment centers, corrections meetings. Well, they made the bad choice. Well, you know, what choices did they really have? What options did they have? You know, or that they were aware of. That's the key thing. Were they aware of these things? You know?
That is really critical, and I want to. We have just barely under 2 minutes left here before we have to break, and I wanted to emphasize that if people want to contact the Justice Project and yourself, the website justiceprojectkc.org. There is a link on the main menu that is titled "I Want to Help." And it contains the phone number, the P.O. box, and the other information that you said earlier, Chris. Do you have any final closing thoughts to talk about the work that you and your team are doing?
You know, it just is constantly reiterated to us in the work we do how amazing these women are out there and how incredible it is that they're surviving. And people say, well, they're not survivors until they're off the streets. No, if they're still out there and they're not dead, they're survivors. And we just wish that people could look past. They might look raggedy, they might look dirty, they might be out there running around with no shoes on, dead winter, twirling around like a maniac at Linwood and Truth. But have some compassion in your heart for those people, because you don't know what's behind that. And people just need to love one another. They need to be kind to one another. They need to forgive one another right now. And we need to embrace our diversity and look for to 2021 as being much more hopeful and better. And love one another, folks.
Yeah, that is a great note to end the hour on. Thank you
so
much.
Thank you, Una.
And Fiona and Rachel, and thank you so much for being on our show this week.
Fiona, did you,
you
have
bet.
Fiona,
thank
did you.
You
have any final words?
And Fiona, be well, dear.
Thank you. You too, Chris. And always let us know if there's anything we can do to help, and we can also share the information with our KTFI community. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for your support.
Thanks so much. Urban Connections is next. Thank you for listening to the Every Woman Show. We'll be back next week.